My goal, my hope in this talk, in this book, is that by uncovering these alternative historical narratives about Brown, these historical alternatives to the civil rights law, we can broaden our imagination about the possibilities for addressing the remnants of Jim Crow that still face the nation today.
Good morning and welcome to the Miller Center Forum. It's a real pleasure and a privilege to introduce Risa Goluboff. Risa's recently ascended to the rank of full professor of law and history at the University of Virginia. She earned her doctorate in history from Princeton University. She is a graduate of Yale Law School, and she received her undergraduate education at Harvard. After completing her legal education, she clerked for United States Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. She participated here in June of 2004 in the symposium that we held, The Road to and From Brown v. Board of Education, a Critical Reexamination. And at that symposium, she initially exposed some of the ideas that are more fully developed in her book. Her new book, The Lost Promise of Civil Rights, has received extraordinary praise from professional historians and book reviewers, and it is with a real sense of excitement that I introduce Risa Goluboff.
Thank you for coming. It's great to be here. The book that I'm here to talk to you about today is a history book. And what I'm going to talk about is mostly historical. But I just wanted to start out by saying why it's important to talk about this history, what makes it still important and alive today. When I started the project that culminated in this book, I was trying to figure out a puzzle. And the puzzle was, why does it seem that the Constitution is unable to respond to claims about the racial inequalities that I see in the world around me today? And that question has only become more and more pertinent if you think about the Supreme Court opinion last June in the desegregation cases, the school desegregation cases. It seemed a puzzle to me how it could be that the Constitution prohibits state and local governments from classifying people on the basis of race, even if their goal is to try to fix things, to try to ameliorate racial inequality. So I ask myself, how did we get to the place where we have formal equality, where we no longer have signs above water fountains, where we no longer have formally, legally, explicitly segregated schools, but we still have vast inequalities in wealth, vast inequalities in educational achievement, vast inequalities in political power, vast inequalities in the way we experience crime and the criminal justice system. And all of these inequalities are still racially identifiable. They're still correlated very deeply with race. The most provocative way to put this question, I think, would be, what makes the racial ghetto, the poor racial ghetto, constitutionally acceptable? How is it okay that in 2007 it's still the case, not entirely, but to an extent, that race and poverty are intertwined? And how do we get to the place where the Supreme Court thinks that the Constitution not only need not, but cannot allow governments to fix these remaining racial and economic inequality? So that's my puzzle. That's the question I'm trying to answer. And I'm going to answer it historically, but it's clearly a very live puzzle today. Now, there are lots of moments on the way to 2007 that we might point to as places where we ended up on the path that got us here. And this book and my talk focuses on one, and that's Brown versus Board of Education. It's not a surprising one. It's the case that the Supreme Court was arguing about in these recent school desegregation cases. Brown was the case that set the path, I argue, for where we are today. It dominates our imaginations about what civil rights means, about what the Constitution protects. We all think of Brown as the beginning of a new era. That's what the headlines all said in 1954. We think of Brown as the beginning of a new era of desegregation, a new era in race relations. At the same time, though, Brown was the beginning of a new era because it ended an old era. And the old period was not just a period of segregation and a period of Jim Crow. It was also a period of experimentation in civil rights. It was a period of openness in civil rights, when lots of different people and lots of different lawyers were thinking about civil rights in ways that we don't think about them today. So in particular, the period that I think is crucial to understanding where we are today is the one between the New Deal in the Depression in the 1930s and Brown in 1954. And during that period, civil rights were very different from the way we understand them today. And in particular, they included economic rights and labor rights that have dropped out of our understandings of civil rights, and the labor and economic rights of African American workers in particular. So what I'm going to talk about today is that era, is the things that Brown has obscured for us today, what challenges to Jim Crow look like before 1954, and how once you look at all the challenges before 1954, you see that Brown only fixed some of those things. Brown was a response to some of the challenges, and that current legal doctrine, the current way we think about civil rights, does the same thing. I start in the book with the workers themselves, with African American workers and the complaints that they brought to lawyers. And I do this, we usually, when we think about law, we usually think about courts. We think about Supreme Court opinions, maybe lower courts, maybe legislation, maybe lawyers. But we don't usually think about the regular people who brought the claims. But law starts with those people. They start with someone saying, I've been injured in some way. And you know what? I think the law has something to say about how I've been injured. I think the law can help me. I'm going to bring my problem to a lawyer. And then the lawyer says, yes, I can make this a legal claim, and categorizes it in legal ways and brings it to the courts. And only then do the courts get an opportunity to act on this problem, only after it's been formulated by a person and reformulated by a lawyer and then brought to the courts. So to me, it's impossible to understand law without understanding what regular people thought about the law and what they thought about their legal rights. I think that African American workers' claims were key to understanding civil rights in this period for two reasons that I want to tell you about. The first reason is because these claims try to undermine the whole structure of Jim Crow. What do I mean by that? I mean not just the signs over the water fountains. If you think about what Jim Crow was, it was an eventual replacement, not immediate, but an eventual replacement for slavery. Slavery was a system of racial subordination. It enslaved a particular race of people and only that race of people. And it was a system of labor. It enslaved them in order to get labor out of them, in order to produce goods and agriculture. So when slavery ends after the Civil War, there are two questions on the minds of governing whites in the South. The first question is, how are they going to prevent African Americans from debasing the white race, from debasing white politics? How will they keep them racially cordoned off? And the second question is a labor question. How are they going to replace this labor force that they've just lost? They had cheap labor in African American slaves. How are they going to replace that labor? And Jim Crow, the system of Jim Crow that eventually is created after the Civil War, is an answer to both questions. It's both a system by which Southern whites manage to racially cordon off African Americans, and it's a system by which they try to procure cheap labor. And in being a system of both racial subordination and economic exploitation, Jim Crow is about material things. It's about poverty. It's about economics. It's about goods and houses and land ownership and jobs. And it's also about symbolic things. It's also about formal governmental things, about segregated schools and disenfranchisement in voting. It's about what governments do and it's about what individual people do, what railroad corporations do, what unions do, what restaurant owners do. It's all of these things. It's a holistic system that governs society in all of its aspects. So the first reason that I focus on African-American workers is because the complaints that they bring, and I'm going to talk about them in a minute, the complaints that they bring are complaints against all of that. They're complaints against both the water fountains and the formal segregation, and they're also complaints about the poverty and the lack of economic choices and the lack of economic advancement. So their complaints go to the entire system of Jim Crow. The second reason that African-American workers' claims are central in this period and in my book have to do with the political climate, the political, the intellectual, and the legal climate before Brown versus Board of Education. In the first part of the 20th century, the Supreme Court was not particularly attuned to the civil rights of workers, the civil rights of African Americans, of racial minorities, in the way that when we say civil rights, these are the kinds of rights that come to mind. The Supreme Court was not particularly attuned to these rights during that period. But during the Depression and World War II, notions of rights, there was a revolution in notions of rights. They changed everything. So understandably, obviously, during the Depression, new labor and economic rights came to the fore. The New Deal created economic protections for workers of all kinds, although not all kinds, as we're going to see in a minute, but for many workers. Suddenly, the government is guaranteeing some kind of minimum subsistence. The government is guaranteeing economic security. That's a big watchword of the decade, security, economic security. The government is insisting that workers have rights to unionize, insisting that there be social security. And during World War II, the ideas about fascism and Nazism make people in the United States much more attuned to racial discrimination. And the large numbers of African Americans who are joining the military, who are joining unions, who are moving north into war-related industries, make African American protest much more vocal. And all of a sudden, during World War II, African American workers are saying, "Hey, we get these rights too. We should be getting better jobs. We should be getting to join unions. We should be enjoying all of these governmental protections." So in the 1940s, African-American workers complained to lawyers in all kinds of organizations about rights violations that they perceived, even though they didn't necessarily, they couldn't vindicate them in court, they thought they wanted to try. So agricultural and also domestic workers, especially in the South, complained about involuntary servitude. They complained, there are complaints I detail in the book, where people are essentially enslaved in the 1940s in the United States, virtually enslaved. They complain about violence. They complain about threats of violence. They complain that they've been threatened that they'll be imprisoned if they don't work for a particular employer under particular conditions. They complain that after they've put in almost a year's worth of work in their crops, their employers steal them, and they have no recourse. Often they can't read or write, or they don't have written contracts. The police officers, the judges, are all white. They don't have any recourse to the law. So the agricultural workers' claims show very clearly the ways in which Jim Crow, both this racial system and this economic system, determine and circumscribe and limit their economic fates. In addition, and this is a big point that I try to make in the book, workers, industrial workers across the country, not just in the South, complain about similar, though clearly different, kinds of problems. They complain that they're excluded from whole industries. They're excluded from particular kinds of jobs. They're relegated to the work that is the three H's, hot, hard, and heavy. They do segregated work. They do it in segregated workrooms. They do it in they eat in segregated lunchrooms. They often can't find housing in a particular place because all the housing is segregated. They make less money. They often do the same work, but with a different, they're called a janitor, even though they're acting as a skilled laborer, and they get a janitor's pay instead of a skilled laborer's pay. They suffer violence on the job at the hands of workers, at the hands of mobs, and sometimes they can't even get jobs, even during the boom of World War II, where employers are saying, it's such a tight labor market, we can't find workers to hire. When African-American workers show up and say, here we are, we're ready to work, they're told no, there's no room for them there. And these kinds of complaints are not just in the South. They're across the country. Because if you stop thinking that Jim Crow is only the signs over the water fountain and only the segregated schools that are segregated by law, and you understand it as an economic system as well, then you see that it's a national problem. It's not just a regional problem, but a national one. So civil rights lawyers take these cases in the 1940s. You all have never heard of these cases. I'd never heard of these cases before this project. But civil rights lawyers take these cases, and I talk in particular about two main groups of civil rights lawyers. One are those in the civil rights section of the Department of Justice in the federal government in Washington, and the other are lawyers in the NAACP. And both lawyers, both groups of lawyers, wanted to promote something called civil rights through the law, through the legal system. But they understood civil rights differently. They operated under different constraints, and they saw different opportunities. So the civil rights section were government lawyers. They were in the Franklin Roosevelt administration that had a lot of Southern whites in the administration that made this very politically complicated, right? They're in an organization, a part of the government called the Civil Rights Section. Their job is to protect civil rights somehow, and they try to figure out what they can do that won't offend people in their own administration, that won't offend people in the party that their boss, their ultimate boss, is a part of. And these lawyers are themselves mostly white. So they are afraid to go after Plessy versus Ferguson. They're afraid to try to undermine formal segregation itself. And there are also lots of legal constraints on going after Plessy, because Plessy is good law. It's hard to say, oh, the Supreme Court, you should just overrule it. And at the time, they weren't yet ready to make that kind of claim. So when agricultural workers write to them and say, we're virtually enslaved, please help us, when the mothers of teenagers who are virtually enslaved say, please help me get my son home, they respond. Agricultural workers, the complaints are so desperate, they're so outrageous, they are so clearly unconstitutional under the 13th Amendment of the Constitution, which outlawed slavery after the Civil War, that most white Southerners are appalled by these kinds of circumstances. They're appalled by these complaints. And so the civil rights section lawyers see this as an opportunity to do something meaningful that's not going to offend white Southerners in the Democratic Party. And what they do is they use the 13th Amendment, this amendment against slavery, to try to expand the New Deal protections to workers who had not received them before. The New Deal legislation that created all these new economic rights didn't protect farm workers, and it didn't protect domestic workers. And a big part of the reason why it didn't protect those two groups of people was because in the South, most domestic workers and most African Americans were domestic workers or farm workers. And it was very threatening to offer those protections in legislation to those groups of people. So what the civil rights section lawyers do is use the 13th Amendment to try to protect them, to say, you know what? There should be affirmative governmental protection. It can't be constitutional for someone to live under these kinds of conditions, for someone to face violence every day and be told, you must work for me or you'll be imprisoned, or I will kill you, or I will harm your family. And so what the civil rights section does is they make arguments for affirmative governmental protection against rights violations by both the government and private actors. Not just the government, but any employer who goes about enslaving someone should be liable under the Constitution. So the civil rights section is not just asking governments to stop doing things. Not just saying, don't classify on the basis of race, don't segregate, but saying the government should do things, should protect people affirmatively, should make sure that people don't live under such conditions, should make sure that people have an ability to choose their own economic fates. So that's the civil rights section lawyers. Then there are the NAACP lawyers. And they're situated very differently from the civil rights section lawyers. They are mostly African American. They don't work for the government. They work for a private nonprofit organization that has to answer to their funders, who are mostly white. and has to answer to their membership, who is mostly African-American, initially middle class, but as World War II progresses, more and more northern industrial working class African-Americans join. And as a result, the NAACP takes the cases of industrial workers. And they attack, they go after, they challenge the actions of unions, they challenge the actions of private employers, and they challenge the actions of governments. And they argue not just segregation is bad, not just unions shouldn't be allowed to be segregated, not just government shouldn't be able to segregate or discriminate, but they argue that people have a right to a job. People have a right to make a living. They have a right to work. And they argue, even though the NAACP is always opposed to segregation, the lawyers understand that for workers, it's all very good and nice to say we need to wait until segregation is over, but they need jobs now. And the NAACP goes about trying to get them economic advancement even within the confines of segregation. So they compromise in various ways in order to get economic advancement. And by the end of World War II, the cases of these industrial workers looked very promising. It looked like segregation might be on its way out. It looked like the cases were being won against government, against unions, against private employers. It looked like there might be a right to work in the horizon. But by 1950, the NAACP turns away from these kinds of cases. And they've always been interested in education. They've always been interested in the end of segregation. But during the 1940s, there's this moment when they're looking at workers and they're looking at economic advancement and not just formal equality. And by 1950, labor's out. And these kinds of cases are out. Education is in. And the NAACP is trying to prove that segregation and classification on the basis of race alone are a problem. Now, that makes a lot of sense, right? Plessy versus Ferguson, the 1896 case that had upheld segregation, had said, look, if the government segregates on the basis of race, that doesn't say anything about the worth of particular people. If African Americans feel badly, if they think that's a statement about them, that's their problem. They're the only ones who think it's a statement about them. So it's actually incredibly important for the NAACP to make the claim that it's not just African Americans who are feeling the statement. It is a statement. It is meaningful for government to segregate on the basis of race. It is harmful in and of itself. So if you think of that harm as one kind of harm of Jim Crow, and economic realities as another kind of harm of Jim Crow, they decide that the kind of harm they're going to focus on in 1950 is the symbolic formal equality, stigmatic harm, the stigma of segregation and classification. At the same time, around the same time the NAACP decides to do this, the civil rights section, which is pursuing all these labor cases, loses clout in the Department of Justice to the Solicitor General's office, which is a different office there, that then supports the NAACP in the path that it takes. So suddenly there's nobody advocating within the law for this other kind of civil rights, this more economically based civil rights that would be about real material equalities. So Brown elides all of this history. The case occurs in the education context. The ideas about work and labor rights are gone. Brown focuses on the psychological harms of segregation. It focuses on the stigma, the symbolic stigma of being segregated. And that kind of harm would have looked pretty strange to an enslaved agricultural worker in the pre-Brown era. If you had asked an enslaved agricultural worker in 1945 what the real problem with Jim Crow was, he's not going to say it's the water fountains. He's going to say, look at my life. Look at the conditions of poverty I live in. Look in the violence that I face every day. Look at the exploitation, the lack of choices, the powerlessness. So from a pre-Brown perspective, the idea, the image of Jim Crow that comes across in Brown as central to Jim Crow is really quite striking. And you can see how once Brown happens, everyone's imagination gets taken up with Brown. Legal treatises and casebooks all describe civil rights as being about this symbolic formal equality, and all these other ideas of civil rights fall out. It's quite remarkable to compare casebooks before Brown and casebooks after Brown. because we rewrote our understanding of civil rights from the perspective of Brown. Once we knew it was there, we looked back and found the path to Brown, traced how we got to Brown, and lost out all these alternative ways of thinking about civil rights. So if you think about these recent Supreme Court cases, right, the majority in the Supreme Court today thinks that any governmental decision based on race is a problem, even if it's an attempt to fix real inequalities. The real harm that they see is if the government thinks about race at all. And that was not the notion of harm before Brown. Moreover, the majority in the Supreme Court thinks that even that because the school districts in those cases had never formally segregated, then it wasn't for the government to fix it. Any segregation, any inequalities were not the problem of government, were not the problem of the Constitution. They're merely private things. Well, that wasn't the way people thought about segregation or Jim Crow before 1954 either. They thought private segregation, private exploitation, was equally problematic to governmental segregation and governmental classification. So Jim Crow was a system of formal inequality and material inequality. It was a system of public segregation and private exploitation. And the Brown-inspired vision of civil rights that we live with today only partially undermined that system of Jim Crow. It only undermined the governmentally imposed segregation and discrimination, not the private economic exploitation, not the actual material inequalities. Now, the story wasn't finished after Brown. It's still not finished today. But we're always struggling against the image of Jim Crow and the image of civil rights that Brown created. And then we tell these myths about Brown that limit our imaginations about what we can do, about what the Constitution can possibly redress. My goal, my hope in this talk, in this book, is that by uncovering these alternative historical narratives about Brown, these historical alternatives to the civil rights law that we know as our own, we can broaden our imagination about the possibilities for addressing the remnants of Jim Crow that still face the nation today. Thank you.
I'm going to move to the back corner of the room, and I ask those of you who have questions, and I would certainly encourage people to ask questions, to queue up in the back of the room. And while I'm moving to the back of the room, Reese, I'd like to ask sort of an opening question. Yogi Berra is reported to have said, "When you get to a fork in the road, take it." And you're looking back and saying that in the early 1950s, at the time the NAACP made the strategic decision to pursue these cases, they were at a fork in the road and they took it. 50 years from now, what will our successors as historians and legal historians look back at this decade of the 21st century and say were the crossroads and which are the forks that we should be taking and which are the forks that we should be staying away from?
You know, I do think there's been a lot of discussion about these desegregation cases, and some folks are saying they're really not that important. There aren't that many school districts that are voluntarily trying to integrate their schools. And yet, it seems really important because symbolically, this is a referendum on where we want to head. And what the answer to the referendum is that this Supreme Court has given is we think things are fine just the way they are. And not only, right, the reason these cases are so important is because until now, there's been a debate about affirmative action that's been relatively unsettled. And it's been thought for a long time that school districts could voluntarily do these things. And now the court is telling them they can't. Not just they don't have to, which was a question way back when, but they actually can't. And so the Supreme Court is tying the hands of more and more governmental actors who want to change things. And I think the fork in the road is really, can we continue to do something or must we sit back and do nothing? I don't know if that's a fork so much, right? I think that's a cessation of movement. The Supreme Court can continue ahead or we cannot, and it's hard to see how there's another path. If you really take this to its logical conclusion, I think that there's not really anywhere to go. The only place there is to go that the court suggests or that the concurrences suggest is that governments can try to help fix race under the table by not really talking about race, and that seems problematic.
My name is Lisa Aronson. Thank you. I was wondering about the NAACP's choice to go toward education rather than the previous mandate or work that it was doing, and what shifted their work?
It's a good question, and I talk about it a lot in the book. There are a number of different things. So one aspect of it is it's a doctrinal choice. Plessy is the big case waiting out there that seems problematic. And so by isolating governmental action, segregating education, they can really go after Plessy in a serious way. So that's one part of it. Another part of it is after World War II ends and the Cold War starts to ramp up, the NAACP's position in the political climate changes, and other actors' position in the political climate changes. So before, some of the cases that the NAACP had taken that were the most successful were cases against unions that were segregated or that excluded African-American workers. And after the Cold War starts, the NAACP has a very close institutional relationship with unions. And both NAACP and unions are being attacked by anti-communists in the Cold War period. Not that either is actually communist, but they look a little bit communist, and they're getting attacked, and they're getting tainted. And so they don't want to attack unions anymore. That's their allies now. So the most obvious work-related cases are no longer politically or institutionally feasible. The changing political climate is really important for them to make claims about a right to a job. Sounds a little like socialism, right? And they're really afraid about the communist taint. And then the last thing that I would mention, and these are all, I think, a perfect storm leading to this decision, is class bias. The NAACP has always been really interested in education. For much of their history, they were not particularly interested in workers' rights. They were upper middle class elite African Americans, and that wasn't the kind of thing that they were interested in. During World War II, they couldn't ignore it. It was such a huge thing during the Depression and World War II that they felt these were opportunities they had to take. But at the end of the day, they thought the real problem of Jim Crow was the problem of the water fountain. It was the problem of having the means but not being allowed to go to a restaurant or not being allowed to go to a hotel or not being allowed to attend a particular school. And so I think that their own position, it's understandable, right? When they looked at the world, these were the problems that struck them as particularly important. And those were the problems that they ultimately went after.
Yes, Gordon Hilton. In the late 1930s, but particularly in the 1940s, there are significant movements in a few northern states for anti-job discrimination statutes, culminating in the Ives-Quinn Act in New York in January 1945. And I'm just curious, where are these sort of late 1930s, 1940s civil rights campaigns in the North fit in with the two developments that you talked about?
Yeah, I think those are some of the developments that made workers' rights impossible for the NAACP to ignore. People often talk about how during the 1940s, African-American civil rights became more of a national issue. But it wasn't just African-American civil rights writ large. It was mostly African-American civil rights for workers, right? So the biggest protest of the 1940s is this March on Washington movement, which was all about jobs in war industries, and the response that the Roosevelt administration made was, oh, we'll put into place some anti-discrimination, not particularly toothsome, but we'll put into place some anti-discrimination measures in the form of the Fair Employment Practice Committee. And I think that these state laws are part of the groundswell of support for the rights of African-American workers, and they are another indication of it. They are part of the mobilization of African-American workers, and the NAACP uses those laws to try to effectuate change for African-American workers. They're very much a part of the litigation strategy that the NAACP is making.
Hi, I'm Sheila Blackford, and I have a question sort of piggybacking on George's question, which is, after the Supreme Court decision about desegregation in June, you heard a lot of people talking about, well, let's move away from race and let's focus on economics instead. So if you look at, you know, free and reduced lunch, if you look at, you know, poverty levels and address those instead, we would sort of result in the same bringing up, because poverty and race is often so closely correlated. Can you talk a little bit about the impact of switching the focus from race to economics, and both the legality of it and whether or not you think that will address some of the issues?
So I was going to say, before you ask that last part of your question, one thing I would be clear about is I don't actually think we should switch from race to economic issues. And something that I talk about in the book is these two things are totally intertwined. And it's not that I'm saying we shouldn't have overturned Plessy. It's not that I'm saying Brown was wrong. We needed both. This is a holistic system. And so I actually think to wholeheartedly switch would be a mistake, because racism is alive and well in the United States, and it's pretty well entrenched. And if we just went to economics, I think we would help a lot of the same people. But on the margins, there would be other people who I think we have a constitutional commitment to helping, who we have a historical obligation to helping, who would be left out. As a matter of constitutional doctrine, it's definitely the case that economic programs are much more constitutionally palatable than racial programs. And that's actually partly a result of what I talk about in my book. We separate out race and economics. We say it's okay for the government to do economic legislation, but it's not okay for the government to proactively help on the racial front. And so I do think those kinds of programs are likely to be upheld. But I don't think that they would have exactly the same effect. Certainly to the extent that race and poverty overlap, very poor African-American kids are going to be helped. But if you look at statistics, and I don't have them with me, if you look at statistics, even white and African-American families who have the same income usually don't have the same economic resources. They don't have the same real estate. They don't have the same savings. They don't have the same, right? There are all these ways in which the legacy of discrimination, the legacy of segregation, the legacy of economic exploitation are still with us, even for African Americans who are not in desperate poverty, and I think we have an obligation to make sure that changes as well.
Professor Goldoff, thank you for your talk. I was curious, just also following up about the fork in the road. I guess after these types of cases suggesting that local governments or any type of government can't really take race into consideration, does it just require a reinterpretation by the Supreme Court, or are there other doctrinal hooks that, you know, other actors in the system can rely on? And what's your thoughts about some possible strategies like the Privileges and Immunities Clause, or I don't know, just any, your thoughts would be appreciated.
Yeah, so, you know, one thing that has been going on for 40 years is that Congress uses other powers, not just the 14th Amendment, not just what we would think of as the obvious constitutional places that protect civil rights and protect African Americans. So the Commerce Clause, the big 1964 Civil Rights Act, is on the basis of the Commerce Clause, which says that Congress can regulate interstate commerce. And that was a way of avoiding constitutional problems of Congress addressing racial questions directly. So I think one way, and it's similar to Sheila's question, right, is for Congress itself to say, what we're really doing is economic stuff. We're not really doing racial stuff. And another way is I think, the 13th Amendment. And there have been a lot of legal scholars who have been trying to suggest that the 13th Amendment provides a fair bit of constitutional power and authority. The 13th Amendment is different from the 14th Amendment in that it explicitly does not state that this is about what governments do. It is much easier to say that private actors can be regulated under the 13th Amendment. Now, the problem is, what does the 13th Amendment say? It says slavery and involuntary servitude shall not exist in the United States. So then the problem is, well, what are slavery and involuntary servitude? How far can you open up the definition of involuntary servitude before it becomes a meaningless thing? But that's certainly another possibility. There's a hate crimes law before Congress at the moment, that deals with hate crimes, not just on the basis of race, but sex and sexual orientation and physical disability. And part of it Congress has based on the Commerce Clause, and part of it, the racial part, Congress has based on the 13th Amendment. They haven't used the 14th Amendment at all. And I think they're on relatively good constitutional footing there.
Risa, I enjoyed your talk. I'm Phil Cooper, a local resident. Do I understand you to suggest that there are basically two types of segregation, the symbolic or racial, and the economic? If I understood you correctly, then it's not clear to me why the education, opening education, is a curing of racial segregation. To me, I see it as an economic issue, and so I don't see much of a fork in the road there.
Yes, so what I would say is it's not that there's racial segregation and economic segregation. I would say that there's racial segregation and classification, and there's economic inequality. And so by challenging segregated education, I agree. I think the NAACP thought, and to some extent it's true, it has been made true, that if you open up education for everyone, then people will get better educations, they'll get better jobs, and they'll improve economically. Absolutely. That was one of the theories, and to some extent I think it has proven true. But it's a question about the way in which education was opened up. So what the court required in Brown was the end of states and localities having laws that segregate schools. That is no longer okay. A state or a local government cannot have a law that segregates schools. But schools are actually, for the most part, more actually segregated today than they were a long time ago. And so what I'm trying to make a distinction between is not necessarily, part of it is economic and racial, but part of it is formal and actual. We now don't have laws that impose this upon us, but we still live in a world in which it's largely true that schools are segregated and that the schools that are primarily attended by African Americans and other racial minorities are worse. So they're still not getting the kind of education that was envisioned. It's no longer a result of active, aggressive, formal segregation, but it is a result of actions taken by both governments and private individuals that we no longer seem to think the Constitution has anything to say about.
Yeah, thank you for your talk. I wanted to mention, I think I'm sympathetic to your argument because the NAACP does the same thing in regards to focusing on the death penalty in its litigative strategy versus other crime policies like the 1968 Safe Streets and Crime Control Act. However, I wonder how much, and I would push you on this, do you assign too much power to the NAACP LDF in shutting down that alternative track towards a focus on material inequality? And to what extent other actors were constraining the strategic choices of the NAACP elites and other advocacy groups?
Absolutely. They were absolutely constrained in the choices that they made. I don't mean to say that they made them in a vacuum. I think that they were constrained by anti-communist race baiters. They were constrained by the unions and their relationships with the unions. They were constrained by their funders and their members. They were constrained by courts. All the way through, they're constrained by courts. They're constrained by legal precedents. So I would say, in answer to your question, two things. One is, absolutely, they are constrained. And throughout the book, I do think they have some agency, and I point out where I think they're making choices, but absolutely I agree that their choices are constrained. And then the second thing I would say is, at the end of the day, it's not just the NAACP who cuts off these paths, right? The NAACP crafts this case and presents it to the Supreme Court, right? And the Supreme Court embraces their vision of the case, but then we all embrace it too. And the casebook writers embrace it, and the treatise writers embrace it, and the scholars embrace it, and the lawyers who follow embrace it, right? You've got a victory. What are you going to do? You're going to push on with your victory. And it's only natural that people are following in its path. So it's both that they were constrained and that there are a whole host of actors, once Brown happens, that snowball and reinforce this, and it's not only the NAACP that does that.
I have a two-part question. The first part is, what possible remedies do you see for
districts that are almost entirely minority or white. So it's a matter of the entire district and not individual schools. And the second part is, what do you see as the future of affirmative action in college admissions?
For the districts, you know, there was a case about 30 years ago in which the Supreme Court said, if there is no inter-district segregation problem, if the state hasn't created this problem across districts, then the Constitution's not going to remedy the problem. Now, that case could be revisited, as all cases can be revisited, but there is a doctrinal problem with trying to integrate across district lines in the circumstances that you describe. But I actually think that one of the lessons that I hope would be taken from my book is that the focus on formal desegregation, I think that's been overemphasized. And if you go back to Phil Cooper's question, if the goal is better education toward better economic achievement, toward actual equality, it's not clear to me that integration is the only way to achieve that goal. I'm not willing to really jettison integration totally, but I do think that it's the case that better education is really important, and I'm not the only one to say this, right? Derek Bell has been saying this for a long time, and others have as well, but it certainly does seem to me that the focus on formal integration doesn't have to be the case, that comes partially out of Brown and out of our understanding that the harm is symbolic and stigmatic and not about what kind of school you go to and whether you've got new books and whether you've got good teachers and whether you can go to school and there not be violence there and you're actually in a situation that's conducive for learning. As for college admissions, I don't know. We can all read the tea leaves. Certainly, the majority was careful not to upset the college admissions affirmative action cases from a few years ago, the Grutter and Gratz cases. I wouldn't put my money that if those cases came up again, this court would uphold them again. I think that they think that any governmental decision on the basis of race is really problematic, and that would go for college admissions as well. You know, to the extent that Grutter says something otherwise, the law school admissions case from 2002, I think, says something otherwise. What it basically says is, integration and diversity are good because white people need to learn how to get along with minorities. and integration and diversity are good because we don't actually want all that revolution and we need to make it look like there's actually stepping stones to power for minorities. I read those cases very, very cynically. I don't think they're particularly robust protectors of minority rights. And I don't think that this court is likely to uphold them in the future, although they were trying, they were trying not to overrule everything all at once, and so they kept them in place now, but I'm not sure that's a sincere belief.
Hi, Professor. You mentioned that the NAACP, in pursuing its initial strategy, essentially compromised in some senses in working within the constraints of the system of segregation that existed at the time, and I wondered that if the NAACP and other societal actors, and perhaps with the clout of the Justice Department behind it, had retained its initial focus, whether you believe there was any danger, what the likelihood would have been that the system of segregation would have endured longer, even as the conditions of African Americans were ameliorated.
That's definitely possible. There's a review of my book in The American Lawyer recently where the reviewer, Danny Greenberg, said that he got the feeling that had the NAACP and the Justice Department gone the other way and not challenged segregation but got more economic advancement and more actual equality, I still would have written a book about the alternatives not taken, right? And I took that as a good thing. I took that to mean he really got my book. I really mean that. I think both things were necessary, and it's not clear to me which one had to come first, or if one had come first, which one wouldn't have come next. I do think it more likely, had we achieved greater actual equality, the end of segregation would have come as a more likely consequence than the direction we ultimately took. But I don't know that we could have known that at the time, right? I actually think that Thurgood Marshall and the NAACP lawyers thought The real problem is legal segregation, and once that ends, everything's going to fall into place. I think they were quite surprised that everything didn't fall into place after that. So it's hard to second guess. It's hard to know counterfactually what would have happened had we gone the other path. But I do think both were absolutely necessary, and I wouldn't have been satisfied had they all gone the other way and Plessy were still good law today. That wouldn't satisfy me either.
I want to try to understand how far you're willing to go. For example, looking at your own credentials, very impressive, I'm plainly disadvantaged vis-a-vis you in many respects. Part A is, should I have legal redress for my disadvantage? Part B is, let's assume everything is the same, but I'm black. Should I have legal redress for my disadvantage, for example, vis-a-vis you?
I honestly don't know the answer to that question. I guess I would say this. I teach first-year law students constitutional law. And on the first day, I talk about Martin Luther King and Frederick Douglass and slavery. And I talk about how constitutional law, it's a general class. I teach them lots and lots of things about constitutional law. But what I say on the first day of class is, I don't think you can understand this Constitution, and I don't think you can understand this country unless you understand race. And unless you understand slavery. And so that leads me to think that we have to take pretty radical steps when it comes to changing the racial inequalities in this country. I think they are really the central problem that we face as a nation. And I say that as a woman, I say that as a Jew, I there are all these things that may be better for me if I were to think those were the central problem, but I really think slavery and the legacy of African-American inequality in this country is the central problem that we need to deal with. And that might lead me to say that the answer to your first question is no, and the answer to your second question is yes.
Would you put your scholarship in conversation with the situation going on with the Gina Six in the American South?
With
the Gina Six? The six African Americans who are being charged with attempted murder because of racially motivated fights that happened at a high school.
Oh, well then I've missed this. Will you tell me more about it and then I can try?
Essentially what's happened is over the past year, there have been a number of issues that have happened at a school. I think it's Louisiana. Is it Louisiana? In Louisiana, and racially motivated fights that started because there was, in a high school, a tree that sits out front that's called the white tree, and only white students gather there on any given day. And an African-American student asked the principal at the beginning of the academic year last year, I believe, whether or not he would be able to sit underneath the white tree. The response from the principal was, you may sit anywhere you would like. When all of this began to play out, the next day that students came to school, I believe there were three nooses that were hanging from the tree. The students that were found to be responsible for that act were only given 3 days worth of suspension, saying that it was not necessarily there wasn't ill will that could have been attached to that, that there wasn't any violence that could have come from that, that it was just a ruse, a joke that was being played. After that took place, I don't know what the passage of time was, but there was a racially motivated fight with a young man who evidently was saying things that were not pleasant to be said, and there were six students who inflicted violence upon this young man. He was taken to the hospital and released the same day. But then when the court cases came out, there was attempted murder charges that were connected with this fight. And this has been going on for a year. I think now we're starting to get a little more press about it, probably in the last 6 months or so. But ruling was beginning to come up, I think, in July or so, definitely in the past couple of months. So now there are all of these defense funds for this group of quote-unquote disadvantaged African Americans who are under ridiculous amounts of bond money. So that's the genus six as it's being referred
to. So I hadn't heard that term. I remember the tree, and I've heard about various parts of the story. But as a historian, I often miss the current events. But I do know what you're talking about. I think that in the criminal justice system, and this goes back to Vessel's question as well, right? The criminal justice system is one of the places where you see this the most. There was just a statistic that 49% of murder victims are African American, even though 12% of the population is African American. I mean, think about what that means for the country and the statistics about the processing of minorities in the criminal justice system are also incredibly disparate, right? From the point of who gets targeted to be arrested, to the point of when police stop people, whether they actually arrest them or send them home, to the point of what they get charged with, to the conviction rates, to the sentencing levels, to the probationary terms. I mean, at every point of the criminal process, not just exonerations, not just capital punishment, at every point of the basic everyday criminal process, there is racial discrimination. And at least as you tell the story, right, there were clearly moments at which white people were doing things that should have been hate crimes, that should have been prosecuted, that should have garnered much more opposition. And yet it's not until African Americans act in response that the criminal justice system comes into play. And, you know, it all goes back to, I think, the very deep level at which much of our society, much of the institutions that govern our society is still infused with racism. It's still the case that, and this is why, in answer to Sheila, right, this is why I don't think it's an answer just to go to economics. I think that the racial prejudice, not just in individuals, but in institutional structures, is just so deeply rooted. And, you know, every once in a while, there are big cause celebs like this, and you can trace them back to Scottsboro, right? And they come out, and everybody says, whoa, there's a problem. There's a problem. But there's a problem every day, all the time, and it only comes to the surface every now and then. And we think of it episodically and not structurally, and so I think we have more trouble redressing it because we don't think about it structurally. We think about it as an extreme episode that's an aberration, and I don't think that's what it is.
Hi, my name is Carolina Federos. I'm an undergraduate student. My question is that in American society, it's sort of difficult to address issues in terms of race because it's a social construct that's been fashioned by law for so long. And yet, you know, minorities every day face racial discrimination in terms of acquiring housing and acquiring jobs. And these instances of racial discrimination directly lead to economic disparities and worsen racially segregated communities. And yet there's this strange disparity in terms of white Americans feeling that racial discrimination is almost non-existent anymore, and black Americans feel that racial discrimination is, in fact, worsening. How do we address these issues and tackle this problem head on and, you know, address this disparity in terms of public opinion?
George, you meant we have time for a question but not an answer, right? that's a hard question. I think that's the question that we're all trying to answer. And I guess, you know, one possible answer to the fork in the road with the Supreme Court is maybe we can't do it through law, right? Maybe, I don't actually think that's true, but maybe to some extent the law isn't the best tool at the moment, and it takes re-education of a kind, right? There, before Brown, lots of people thought, society's working pretty well. Lots of white people thought, we don't have a problem, right? And we only got a problem when those outside agitators came. We only got a problem when professional organizers came. Before that, race relations were just fine, right? So it might not actually be a new thing that whites think everything is fine and minorities don't. That was the case for a long, long time, that whites thought everything was fine and minorities didn't. And then there was upheaval. And now that we've achieved formal equality, I think we're in that place again. And so it takes, I don't know if it takes these kinds of episodic incidents to make people think, whoa, things aren't really fine. And the one that I thought you were talking about, which I was incredibly disturbed by, and I wonder what other people think about, is these six white folks who kidnapped this mildly retarded African-American girl and took her to a trailer for 2 weeks and tortured her and yelled racial epithets about. I mean, most white people that I talk to on an everyday basis wouldn't think that could happen in this country today. And yet it can, and yet there's a continuum between that and I think what the Supreme Court says we don't have to do anymore on race, right? And they're all related, and so I think there is a process of a new process of education, of revelation, of illumination that needs to take place. And maybe that happens in law and maybe it doesn't happen in law, but it's big. It's a big thing.
Please join me in thanking Risa Goldberg.